thank you for inviting me to come along. I always enjoy coming to Newcastle, although I have to say, I mean, coming to Newcastle is a bit of a weird thing to say, really, given that I'm actually still in my flat in Glasgow. But, yeah, I do have a very soft spot for the Newcastle Sangha and the Newcastle Centre. I've also got a very soft spot for Parinirvana. The Parinirvana Day Festival is a festival that's really, well, very dear to my heart, actually, for a number of reasons. So 43 years ago, on Parinirvana Day, I became a Mitra in the Glasgow Buddhist Centre. I then spent quite a lot of those 43 years in other parts of the world, and not that long ago came back to Glasgow. But it's also been an important festival or celebration or day of reflection, because I'm somebody who has had a lot of loss and death in my life. Even, you know, before I became involved in Buddhism. In fact, it was one of the things that spoke to me very strongly when I met the Dharma, was the kind of understanding of impermanence that you get in the Dharma. Because from a very young age, I had been very familiar with people dying. Family, even friends. People around. I came from quite a big extended Irish, Italian, Catholic family. So whenever there was a death, it wasn't hidden particularly. So even as a child, we went to funerals or, went to the wake and watched the adults getting drunker and drunker and, sort of played around. So in some ways, death was not unfamiliar to me. But when I met the Dharma, it made a lot more sense to me to see it in that context. So the celebration of Parinirvana Day, I think you've already had a festival at the centre. And what we're doing in that festival generally is kind of reflecting on the death of the Buddha, the fact that the Buddha actually, his physical body and his remains went, as it were. He came to the end of his lifespan. But it's also an opportunity to reflect a bit on our own experience, perhaps, of loss. And at a deeper level, reflect a bit on our own, the fact of our own mortality. The fact that at some point, those of us who are here in this call, all of those that we love and hold dear will at some point no longer be present physically in the world in the way that they currently are. So I'm going to read a little bit from the Mahaparinirvana Sutta, which you probably heard readings from on the day whenever you celebrated it. But I wanted to just lay the scene of the Buddha's Parinirvana and then move on to talking a bit more generally about loss. So, in fact, this comes from the Mahaparinirvana Sutta, but the bit that I'm going to read initially, it's not the Buddha who's died, but one of his very close disciples, Sariputra. And at the death of Sariputra, some of the other disciples, most notably Ananda, is quite upset, and he's talking to the Buddha about this and saying, you know what it's like when somebody close to you dies, and you kind of say, oh, but, you know, he was such an important person in my life and he was so present for me and etc. And then the Buddha says, Ananda, have I not already told you that there is separation and parting and division from all that is dear and beloved? How could it be that what is born, come to being, formed and subject to fall should not fall? That is not possible. So the Buddha's saying at that point, he's saying everything which has been born will at some point die. Sariputra is no different, and he's saying he himself is no different. Later through the Mahaparinirvana Sutta, you hear that little phrase, you hear that passage again and again, Have I not told you that there is separation and parting and division from all that is dear and beloved? How could it be that what is born, come to being, formed and subject to fall should not fall? That is not possible. And then later, as we come to the Buddha's own death, his own parinirvana, we hear the Buddha saying, he addresses the whole Sangha that's there with him, and he says, "Indeed, I declare this to you. It is in the nature of all formations to dissolve, attain perfection through diligence." So those, we're told, are the last words of the Buddha. And I know that, I think there's a few people in the call who've been ordained, and some who've perhaps are training to be ordained in the order. And part of our ordination ceremony is that, to say that, those exact words, all that has been born will pass, with diligence strive on. Now, I believe that Akupa gave a talk last week or very recently where he looked kind of at the second part of that, with diligence strive on, looking at mindfulness. I'm actually going to look at the first bit of that, the everything that arises will pass. So just to, as the more succinct version of it is when the Buddha says, it is in the nature of all formations to dissolve. It is in the nature of all formations to dissolve. So this is the Buddha's basic teaching. It's the most, it's like Buddhism 101, really. And when we're celebrating this, we're celebrating the fact that the Buddha's death, the death of the physical body of the Buddha, is, as it were, a living example, if you can say a living example about a death. It's a living example of that law of impermanence. Even the body of the Buddha was subject to old age, was subject to death. It was subject to the arising and the passing. Excuse me. So impermanence is, if you like, the strongest lesson that we can take away from that. And I think that loss, impermanence and death has been so present, probably for all of us, through this last year with the COVID pandemic. A few days, I gave a similar talk, probably pretty much the same talk, on Sunday, as part of the Glasgow Buddhist Centre's Parinirvana celebrations. And the day before that, I had a look at the statistics. And at that point, 2,360,000 people had died of COVID or COVID-related illnesses during the pandemic. That's quite a lot of people, 2,360,000. It's kind of almost half the population of Scotland, actually. It's a bit less. Population of Scotland is just over 5 million. So it's almost half of that. I know it's a slightly daft way to think of it, but it helps me to kind of put that kind of figure into some sort of perspective. And of course, then there's all the other reasons why people have died through the last year. I don't know how many deaths have happened across the globe. And I imagine by this point, the pandemic, we're in lockdown number 3 up here. We're in the, you know, like all sorts of things changing and happening. And I imagine that by this point, most of us on the call, in the room, will know somebody who has either had COVID, has COVID, or has died from COVID. Even if we don't directly, most of us will probably know of somebody. I'm always quite surprised. So every now and again, somebody writes on Twitter saying, does anybody know anybody that's actually had COVID? And I think, what planet are these people living on? I mean, I might be wrong. Maybe there are other people here who've not known anybody, but I don't know anybody that doesn't know anybody, if you know what I mean, who has been affected by this pandemic. And it's, you know, I think I sort of wonder in a way whether we yet know the effect that this pandemic is going to have had on us. And I don't just mean the physical effects, but also the mental, you know, to mental health, to sort of senses of isolation, senses, a sense of grief that's maybe bigger than the personal. You know, I think I think we won't know for a while. And I'm also aware that, you know, there's sometimes conversations talk about going back to normal. When will we be back to normal? And I don't know if we'll ever really be quite back to normal. I mean, I think this pandemic has highlighted certain things about how society deals with things, about how we are, that I would personally hope we never go back to the normality or business as usual, because I think there was a lot wrong with business as usual. I think there's been learnings from this pandemic. People have said they've learned things like you can actually live a bit more simply. You don't actually have to travel as much as maybe you thought you did. You know, all sorts of kind of things that maybe we've learned. And I think one thing that's really, really struck me through the pandemic, not new, but it's been highlighted, is I've heard again people say, oh, well, we're all in the same boat with the pandemic. It's a load of bloody rubbish. We're not in the same boat. We might be sailing on the same sea of the pandemic, but the boat that I'm in is a much more privileged boat from the boat that many people across the globe are in. Even within the UK, even within Scotland, even within Glasgow, even within my own friends grouping, there's very, very different circumstances. People are having to live this in very different ways. So I was thinking about how some of you will be familiar with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's work on grief and bereavement, I would imagine. And she outlines five stages that we go through, this kind of sub-stages, but five major stages that we go through in grief. And it struck me that in some ways we've been going through that with the pandemic, going through some of these stages. So I won't say much about them, but just to kind of give the context there. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression and acceptance. So, you know, I think certainly see denial, and I, you know, certainly kind of know in myself, in a way, there was a kind of stage where I didn't really quite take on board what was happening with the pandemic. I was actually in Venezuela this time last year. And the friend that I was staying with, an order member there, her son was in China, right in the heart of what was happening. And she was speaking to him every day on the phone and telling us what he'd said. And it really kind of, that was the period where they'd already gone into a kind of house lockdown. They weren't even going out to shop. They were getting food brought to them. It was really extreme, and sort of thinking, oh my God, that's really extreme, isn't it? You know, why on earth would they go to quite those lengths? And then coming back on the plane, I was sitting near, coming from Paris to Glasgow, I was sitting near people who'd come from Singapore, and they were all wearing masks, and they were talking about this pandemic, they weren't calling it a pandemic, but this virus that had... So when I came back to Scotland in February, I was already kind of quite aware of it. But I was talking to a lot of people who just were really thinking, ah, it's just the flu. I know there are still people who do think that, and perhaps some of you believe that it's kind of no worse or no better than the flu. My own feeling is that I've, you know, come to the conclusion it is different from the flu, and that we are having to deal with something that is substantially quite different from anything we've dealt with in my lifetime. And I suspect it's probably not the last time we're going to have to deal with something like this. And then anger, you know, I mean, how easy, it's like it's really easy to get quite pissed off with what's happening, what isn't happening, whether the government are dealing with it well or they're not dealing with it well, and, you know, another lockdown, etc., etc. And then I quite like the bargaining phase, like, well, if we kind of do a lockdown now, can we go on holiday in the summer? This is kind of somehow, in a way, there's genuine negotiation has to happen. Like today in the First Minister's briefing, she was here in Scotland, she was saying, well, we have to make some sacrifices in this area so that kids can get back to school. You know, so there's always negotiations going to happen. But I think there's also a kind of attitude of bargaining. And I think depression, I mean, I've felt personally, I've touched kind of quite low, dark places, particularly in this lockdown. Wasn't that bothered before, but this one's kind of got to me a bit more, definitely been a bit more up and down. And then the whole thing of acceptance is quite a high kind of high value. And I'm going to say a bit more about acceptance later on. The other thing that's been in my mind quite a bit recently, thinking about grief, was, I don't know how many of you have watched It's a Sin. If you haven't watched it, I completely recommend it, particularly if you're of a certain generation, which I know some of you are. I am. And, you know, just it's so exquisitely done and it's so excruciating. It's so painful and heartbreaking. So it's brought back to me a lot of memories because I actually worked in the HIV field through from like the mid 80s until the early 90s for about 8 years, 9 years. I worked as a counsellor. So that brought a lot of that back into my mind, that kind of period of the 80s. And sort of going through all those different stages of grief around what was happening in the way HIV and AIDS. And one of the things that I became very aware of was how it brings into focus very sharply what one wants from life. So I think one of the important things about the Parinirvana Day celebrations is that although we're focusing on the death of the Buddha, we're also focusing on what he did with his life. And one of the important things about focusing on impermanence is to also, the other side of that coin is the preciousness of this present moment, the preciousness of what we've actually got. And I meant to read something to you which for me speaks quite strongly about this, about coming towards acceptance. In the 80s sometime, probably maybe even the early 90s, I went to see a play in London. I was living in London at the time. And I went with a friend to see a play called Antigone. Note the Antigone of Greek tragedy. The Antigone, it's written by, it was a French, originally a French play written, can't remember, maybe in the 30s or something. And it's a kind of meta tragedy. It's a tragedy about tragedy. And there's a speech, a monologue kind of in the middle of it. And I can still, if I shut my eyes, I can still see and hear this monologue. It was this young, very beautiful guy who was probably African British, Caribbean British. And he was wearing a white suit. So it was very striking. And the light was very striking on him. And he was kind of casually leaning against a doorway. And just gave this, it's a very long monologue and I'm not going to read the whole monologue to you. But I want to share a bit of it with you because for me it points me in that direction of what acceptance is and isn't. So he's talking about tragedy basically. He says, the spring is wound up tight. It will uncoil of itself. That is what is so convenient in tragedy. The rest is automatic. You don't need to lift a finger. The machine is in perfect order. It has been oiled since time began and it runs without friction. Death, treason and sorrow are on the march and they move in the wake of storm, of tears and of stillness. Tragedy is clean, it is restful, it is flawless. In a tragedy, nothing is in doubt and everyone's destiny is known. That makes for tranquility. The whole sky has fallen and all you can do about it is shout. Now, don't mistake me, I said shout, I did not say groan, whimper, complain. That you cannot do, but you can shout aloud. So there's a lot in that for me, and I'm not going to go through the, hopefully it'll say something to you of that thing of the kind of inevitability of things. Something's set in motion and actions have consequences, conditions are there, things change, and there's an inevitability to impermanence. But what I wanted to share with you, as much as the quote, was the response to the quote. So I'd gone with this pal to see this play, and we were on the bus going back to Bethnal Green. And I said to her, we started talking about the play, and I said, oh God, for me the most striking bit was that monologue about tragedy. I said, God, I was so furious listening to that. I was so angry. I waited to smash the theatre. I mean, honestly, it's quite interesting. I had such a strong response when he was talking about the kind of, it's restful. I was thinking, it bloody well is not restful. It's horrible. I'm not into this at all. Just, I wouldn't swear at a Buddhist thing, but, you know, just go away. And my friend said, oh, that's really interesting. She said, I just wanted to go to sleep. She said, I found it the most seductive thing I've heard in theatre for a long time. She said, I just wanted to lie down and let it just wash all over me. I thought that's really interesting. It was like there were such extreme responses. And it was quite an insightful moment for me because it made me kind of think afterwards. In a way, neither of those responses is acceptance. I mean, my response was pretty obviously not acceptance. You know, if you've actually got to the stage of accepting something, you're not shouting, swearing and blinding at the, you know, one that's in front of you. So I was definitely not accepting it. And, but my friend's wasn't acceptance either. She'd gone passive. It was like, there was just a kind of, she just wanted to shut her eyes and just like let it, make it go away. So we both wanted it to go away. But we had different ways to try and make it go away. I was wanting to push it away. I wanted to fight back. Whereas she was just for going to sleep. And in a way, it just made me think about how much I personally come up against the things that I don't like in life. You know, so it's not just about the big things like death and impermanence and illness and pandemics. It can be something quite small as well. When things are not going the way that I'd like them to go, my personal response is to fight. You know, I don't really do flight, and I kind of can do freeze, but I mainly do fight. And actually, that was a real thing for me, thinking, well, here I am, I've been practicing as a Buddhist for quite a long time by then, well, 15 years or something. You know, I've been in the order for quite a long time. You'd think I'd have got to a point where I was able to go, yes, impermanence is wonderful, and embrace it, but I obviously was not quite at that point. But it was important as well to recognise that we do have those sort of responses, you know, that anger or the kind of not being able to quite face it. Because I think acceptance of in a real sense is quite hard won by. And I want to share with you a story from the Pali Canon where I think that acceptance is highlighted and expressed. But before I do that, I just want to say that for me, one of the things that I found most helpful in the kind of coming to learn what acceptance might be is the serenity prayer that is said in 12-step meetings, and you know, people will be familiar with it, I would think. It's quite common. So grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And it's really important to know the difference because, you know, my friend's response was a bit along the kind of, she wasn't going to change, that wouldn't change the things that you can change if you just kind of go to sleep. But mine wasn't very helpful either because I was trying to change the inevitable. So there's a lot of energy can get wasted in either of those ways forward. So the wisdom to know the difference is quite helpful. And the story I wanted to share with you, again, it will be very familiar, I would imagine, is the story of Kisa Gotami. So I don't know, I mean, I'm not quite sure. Some of your faces I know quite well. Some of you I know very well. Some of you I know I've seen before and some of you I've never seen before, so it might be that you're not as familiar with some of these stories as I'm thinking you might be. So I'll say a little bit. Kisagotami was a woman who was lived at the time of the Buddha. Her story can be found in a series of texts called the Terigata, the Songs of the Sisters. And anyway, she was married, she had a child. Her husband died, she was left widowed. She didn't have a very good relationship, it would seem, with her family, her in-laws. And she had this child. And in a way, as long as she had that child, she had some status and some position in her family. Sadly, tragically, the child died. And in a way, this was a huge tragedy. It meant the loss of everything for her. It meant the loss, not only the loss of a child, which I personally can't even imagine what that must be like, but it meant the loss of her family, of her status, probably meant the loss of her physical safety, etc. So she was mad with grief. She could not accept what had happened. She was very firmly in the first stage of grief. She was very firmly in denial. She couldn't let that child go. She couldn't put the child down. So she went to healers. She looked for healers to go to, and she said, please, can you save? Can you help? Can you heal my child? And they said to her one after another, but woman, this child is dead. Of course there is no healing for this child. This child is dead. But she couldn't allow herself to hear that. She couldn't allow herself to take that in. So she kind of staggered from person to person, holding. I mean, when you really imagine just carrying this dead baby, trying to find a way to overcome that grief, trying to find a way to make it okay. And finally somebody said to her, well, there is somebody that might be able to help you, and they send her off to the Gautama, the Buddha. She doesn't know anything about Buddhism. She doesn't go to him as a Buddhist teacher. She goes to him because somebody has told her that he might be able to help. And she says to him, please, you know, can you help? Can you heal my child? And the Buddha doesn't say to her, but woman, this child is dead. He says to her, yes, I can help you. She's completely overjoyed. He says, but you must find me a mustard seed. She thinks, a mustard seed will be very easy to come by if that's all that's needed. That's wonderful. He says to her, but there is a proviso. He says, the mustard seed has to come from a home where no one has ever died. So she goes off. She goes from door to door. She knocks the door. She's still carrying this child. She says to each person who opens the door to her, she says, can you help? Gautama has said he can help, but I need a mustard seed. And they say, of course, mustard seeds, we have plenty. Let me give you a mustard seed. She says, yeah, but it has to come. Has anybody ever died in this house? Ever died? Ever? And they say, oh, I'm so sorry, but... And every one of them has their story to tell. I'm so sorry, my mother died here not very long ago. My brother-in-law died here. A child died here. My father died here. Everybody has a story. There is no one single home where nobody's ever died. And at some point she realises death comes to everybody, that this child is dead. So she goes back to the Buddha. She says, I understand. She puts down the child. She's able to bury the child and let go. And she comes back to the Buddha and she says, I want to practice with you. You have shown me the truth of the matter. So she is able to actually accept the death of her child on a very deep and true level, and she becomes one of the Buddha's foremost female disciples. And I always like to think she probably goes on and she does go in and teach other women, but I'm sure, you know, that I kind of have this picture over that she's so deeply compassionate because she's had to live through that herself, that whenever anybody else comes to her that comes from a place of grief, She's just able to embrace them without pushing them, without saying, don't be silly, it's all impermanent anyway, which probably wouldn't be very helpful, but is able to allow them and help them to see the truth of the matter. So what is it that Kisa Gotami has accepted in this moment? She's accepted the true nature of conditioned existence. She's accepted that all phenomena arise in dependence upon conditions, and that with the cessation of those conditions, the phenomenon ceases to exist. So she's totally and utterly accepted within her heart exactly what the Buddha said. All things that are formed must pass. Everything that arises must pass. She has come to accept what are known as the three marks of conditioned existence. And the foremost and the most easy to understand of them is impermanence. She's realised the truth of impermanence, that all things are impermanent. But deeper than that, she has realised the other truth that the Buddha taught, which is not only that things are impermanent, that phenomena is impermanent, that all conditioned things, existence is impermanent, but that within conditioned existence, within each phenomenon, there is no substance, there is nothing which remains unchanging through time. There is no soul. I mean, there's a poetic soul, perhaps, but what the Buddha taught was there is no entity within us which is unchanging and lasts forever, and which does not arise through conditions, which is just there, in a sense. And the third of those marks of conditioned existence is the painfulness of the realisation of that. It's dukkha, the unsatisfactory nature. But it's not so much that conditioned existence is unsatisfactory. The unsatisfactoriness comes from our not being able to live in harmony with those truths. If we could really live in harmony with the arising and the passing of phenomena, we would live much more joyfully in the moment, because we spend so much time wondering where we've come from, and perhaps even less constructively worrying about what's happening in the future. Now, we have to be realistic. We have to know, we have to plan, we have to think ahead, etc. But we can't control and condition the world around us. And I think, again, that's been very obvious through this last year. If I may quote the Scottish eternal bard Robert Burns, who said, "The best laid schemes of mice and men gang after glee and lee is nought but grief for promised joy." So, you know, there are other sayings that say the same thing, you know. I think it's a Jewish saying that says, "Man plans and God laughs." You know, it's like, or Sangha actually wrote a poem called "Life is King," which goes through, well, do it, you know, you set it all up, but actually at the end of the day, life happens. Death happens, impermanence happens. So we can find joy in our ability, our willingness to embrace that. And the truth that Kisa Gotami also realised in her going from door to door was that death and impermanence are both universal and particular. And that's important as well, I think, because if we only think of the universal, then it becomes abstract. But actually, it's deeply personal. When we lose somebody that we love, or when we lose a job or a livelihood or a relationship, you know, it's not just death, there's loss in so many different ways. When that happens, it's personally painful. But something about knowing the universality of it, I think, can ease the pain. But it doesn't mean that you don't feel it. There's a poem by Wordsworth. I can't remember what it's called. I think it's "For Lucy" or something. And there's just, here's four lines from it, which are really cliched, but I think they're quite moving, and I think they really say something. "She lived unknown, and few could know when Lucy ceased to be. But she is in her grave, and oh, the difference to me." So, you know, Lucy is like every man, every woman, every person, you know, somebody dies, it touches some of us. Most people live and die without actually imprinting themselves on the fabric of the universe in quite the same way that, say, Gautama the Buddha did. I mean, most of us live unknown lives, and yet, for those that love us, they're not unknown. They're deeply, deeply meaningful, and both those things are true. So if I can take you back to my own experience briefly before I start to kind of pull this to an end. As I say, I went into bereavement. I worked as a bereavement counsellor, eventually mainly with people with HIV and AIDS, but before that more generally. And before I did the training, I had to have bereavement counselling myself. And I went to somebody who was training. I was her guinea pig, Malini, who the order members might know. She's a wonderful, wonderful woman who lives in New Zealand now. At that point, she lived in London. And she was doing a training as a bereavement counsellor, and so I was her test case. And the first day I went to her, she said, OK, we're going to draw a family tree, and then I want you to put crosses through everybody that has died. OK, cross, 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 cross. So, and then write down the side the names of anybody that doesn't appear in your family tree, but who you know, has also been a loss for you. OK, cross, cross, cross. There were 36 crosses on this piece of paper. I was 26 years, no, I was 29, I think, at the time. I'd had a lot of death, but, you know, you don't really know that what your experience is different from others, because you just experience what you experience, don't you? And she kind of looked at this. She said, I think I'm going to hand this over to my supervisor. I don't think I can have you as my first client. So it really kind of brought it home to me, actually, that, yeah, I had really suffered a lot of loss in my life. And through my sessions with her, because she did carry on seeing me, I kind of had this massive realisation one day that I had an abandonment complex, which, when you think about it, is not surprising. If 30-odd people in your life before you're 30 have upped and died, it has an effect, and some of it came from quite young. And there was everything. There were tragic conditions. There were everything. There was suicides, probably a murder. There were all sorts of things, you know, that had happened in my, you know, in my life. And just hearing myself telling this to Malini, I thought, oh my God, yeah, this maybe isn't totally normal. I've got an abandonment complex. So I was so pleased with myself for seeing this. I thought, this explains a lot of how I am in a lot of my personal relationships. So I kind of went along to the next session, ready to tell, and I said, and she said, before we start the session, I've got something to tell you. I'm moving to Australia. I was like, what? Another one. Anyway, it was a very meaningful moment when I kind of thought, I had to laugh at it, really. I thought, okay. And I had to also recognise it wasn't actually because of me that she was moving to Australia, even though my first response was that I had been such a terrible client that she'd obviously had to go as far away as you possibly could to get away from me. Anyway, I did realise, I had enough self-awareness to know that this was not the reason she was moving. But what I also realised there, the thinking about this whole thing of an abandonment complex, one of the things about that is that it makes it, if you fear loss, it makes it harder to love. Because we think, why love if you're going to lose, you know? So I realised then that there's a middle way that needs to be found, a kind of middle way between, psychologically speaking, a middle way between a kind of a fear of attachment, because if I get attached, they'll go, on the one hand. But then on the other hand, a kind of just losing yourself completely in things. And I had seen people do that as well and then be devastated. Like my mother, for example, who had gone through many of the same losses that I had and basically couldn't, and attempted suicide. She just couldn't handle that, really, in a way. And I was never going to go that far and lose myself. But on the other hand, I'm not quite expressing this that well, but I saw there was a kind of psychological middle way that was needed between the fear of loss and the kind of unwillingness to accept that loss might happen, something in the middle of that. And that basically was to learn how to love without attachment, which sounds really great, doesn't it? It sounds dead easy peasy, lemon squeezy. But of course it's not, because as soon as we do open our hearts to somebody, we open our hearts to being hurt. We open our hearts to loss. But something about learning how to be able to do that. And I think for me, that's been one of the biggest lessons in my Buddhist life, has been to find that way of not closing off to love, but really understanding what that love is and living it in the moment. I should start to pull myself to a bit of an end, shouldn't I? It's 4:15. I guess I also just wanted to say briefly that it also, part of the insight for me in looking at that was realising that it's not just a psychological middle way, but there's a spiritual middle way in that, between the extremes of eternalism and nihilism. So the kind of eternalist view would be that which I love will last forever. Now, we might not think that about the people that we love, or the doggy that we love, or the job that we love, but on some quite deep level, we possibly think it about ourselves, that something will last forever. So that would be the eternalist view. And the other view is that, well, nothing lasts forever, so you might as well, you know, kind of not bother. And I guess I was psychologically seeing that in terms of, like, well, don't love because it won't last. But on the other hand, falling into believing that what I put my energy into, will somehow I can control it and it will be mine forever. So that spiritual middle way is what the Buddha actually taught. He taught that it's not that there's nothing there. There is process and there is continuity. And everything that I do and everything that I, all my actions will have an effect. But there is nothing fixed in that. It's a constantly changing process. The process itself, if you like, is the continuity. I'm sorry if that seems a bit obscure, and I'm sure that on another occasion a Koopa can explain it to you much better than me with more time. Anyway, I think the main thing I'm trying to say here is embrace loss because it's inevitable, but don't close off to love. Because love is the most important thing. Oh God, that sounds so soppy, but it's true. You know, love is what we can offer. And, you know, like in the end, it's all a mystery anyway, really. We don't really know what happens after death. We don't know whether there is some kind of continuity. The Buddha taught that there's not a fixed continuity that remains after death. But I firmly believe that what I've done and how I am and who I've been will have an effect beyond the point where this physical body gives up the ghost. So, you know, that's a continuity. It might not be a continuity of me-ness, as it were, but there is something which will continue. And I would like to think that what might continue will be touched by and tinged by and coloured by the love that I've felt for people and that I've felt come back to me. Shakespeare's sonnet ends with a couplet which I think really expresses this, which says, "This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, to love that well which thou must leave ere long." So accepting that everything that arises will pass, and yet everything that arises is precious and worthy of our love. A slightly different quote is from Jackson Browne. There's a Jackson Browne song called "To a Dancer," and I think it's in that where he says, "We don't know." He says, "In the, you know, he's talking about how death is a mystery," and he says, "But don't let the uncertainty turn you around. Go away and make a joyful sound." I really love that. Make a joyful sound. So the mark that we leave, even while recognising that it will, you know, everything will pass, let's really make a mark that's joyful. Let's love life. Let's dance with life. You know, let's kind of reflect on impermanence and loss and death only so that we can be more aware of the preciousness of life and the preciousness of this precious moment. And live today as though it were your last day, in the sense of wanting to get every single moment of joy and every single moment of love. And that's what we can give as a gift. There's a Tennessee William play called Orpheus Descending. And in that he says that there's a bit in it where the main characters go to visit this cemetery called Cypress Hill. And one of the characters says to the other one, about all these dead people lying in the cemetery, he says, they chatter together like birds on Cypress Hill, but all they say to us is live, 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 live. That's all they've learned, and it's the only advice they can give us. So that's what I want to leave you with on a day when we're reflecting on the death of the Buddha, and we're reflecting on impermanence, and we're reflecting on our own mortality. Just live, 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 live.